This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The United States is warning jurisdictions in the Mediterranean against working with an Iranian-flagged oil tanker now sailing through the region after being freed from detention by Gibraltar. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said those who assist the vessel risk sanctions.
Anyone who touches it, anyone who supports it, anyone who allows a ship to dock is at risk of receiving sanctions from the United States of America. So if that ship, again, heads to Syria, we'll take every action we can consistent with those sanctions.
The State Department Special Representative for Iran said the U.S. wants to ensure the oil on the tanker is not used by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps to fund its operations. Maritime trackers believe the tanker is headed to the Greek port of Kalamata, arriving next Sunday. But Athens says it has not received any requests for the tanker to dock there. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says he is concerned about the number of short-range missile tests North Korea has launched in recent weeks, disagreeing with President Trump, who has shrugged off their importance. North Korea has carried out 6 short-range ballistic missile tests since late last month, with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un saying they were in response to ongoing joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises that North Korea considers as a threat to its existence. Pompeo also is reported as saying, as the United States and North Korea haven't gotten back to the negotiating table as quickly as possible, the U.S. had hoped to continue the nuclear weapons talks. And Sudan's pro-democracy movement and the army formed a joint ruling body, formally disbanding the military council that took over power after the military's ouster of longtime autocrat Omar al-Bashir back in April. For more news, join us at voanews.com. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro confirmed on Tuesday that his government is talking to senior officials of the United States under the authority of President Trump. Maduro said that secret talks had long been taking place between high officials in his government and the Trump administration. The Associated Press reported over the weekend that the U.S. has made secret contact with Socialist Party boss as close allies of Maduro's inner circle seek guarantees they won't face prosecution for alleged abuses and crimes if they see to growing demands to remove him. Trump repeated on Tuesday the U.S. government is helping Venezuela so that the country resolves its political and financial crisis, which he attributed to socialism. President Trump says the U.S., very far from a recession, even as forecasters point to warning signs that the world's biggest economy is slowing.
I think the word recession is a word that's inappropriate because it's just a word that certain people in the media are trying to build up because they'd love to see a recession. We're very far from a recession. In fact, if the Fed would do its job, I think would have a tremendous spurt of growth.
Trump said he is considering tax law changes to put more money in the hands of Americans, perhaps cutting the payroll taxes that all U.S. workers pay to fund pensions for older workers and retirees, and the manner in which investors' capital gains are taxed. The owner of a California business specializing in a controversial government-sponsored visa program for wealthy foreigners was charged along with 2 associates in connection with a $110 million scheme to defraud investors. Thomas Henderson, owner of the San Francisco Regional Center, a self-styled market leader in the EB-5 business, and 2 accomplices are accused of abusing the visa program and jeopardizing the creation of more than 2,000 jobs in Northern California. The EB-5 program is administered by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service. Under the program, foreign nationals may receive permanent residency, commonly known as a green card, by investing a minimum of $1 million in certain American businesses that create jobs. In poor areas, the minimum required investment to obtain an EB-5 visa is $500,000. And an Australian court Wednesday upheld convictions against Cardinal George Pell, the most senior Catholic to be found guilty of sexually abusing children. The sexual abuse occurred after Pell became Archbishop of Australia's second largest city decades ago. He's been ordered to serve a minimum of 3 years and 8 months before he is eligible for parole. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan will today, Wednesday, swear in its 11-member sovereign council.
This is a new phase of Sudan history. The nomination of this lady, Sudan is respecting the diversity. Muslims, Christians, non-religions, the all Sudanese components have a right to participate.
Scores of civilians were killed and injured this month in a Libyan oasis town. Liberian women will hold a sit-in today, Wednesday, to call President George Weah's attention to rising violence against women. South Sudan fired its foreign minister and replaces him with a woman. And Cameroon sentences 10 separatist leaders to life in prison.
It is actually a disgrace to democracy. This decision will intensify tension in the Northwest and the Southwest. It will intensify killings. It will intensify the destruction of properties.
Prince Ekoso is chairperson of the opposition United Socialist Democratic Party of Cameroon and will examine the increasing insurgent violence against Burkina Faso security forces. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan will today, Wednesday, swear in an 11-member sovereign council that will rule the country for a little over 3 years until elections are held. The names of the 6 civilians and 5 soldiers were announced on television late Tuesday by the spokesperson of the outgoing Transitional Military Council. Farah Aga is chair of the Blue Nile Forum, an alliance of 14 political parties. He says the 11th member of the Sovereign Council is a Christian and the judge who will be administering the oath of office is a woman, something he says is a sign of the inclusiveness of the new democratic Sudan.
The list of the names are mentioned and declared from the spokesman of the Military Transitional Council, Shamsuddin Kabashi.
What do you know about the 11 members?
I know 5 of them from the TMC, the Military Transitional Council, and 5 from FFC. The member number 11 is a lady. She's a Christian.
Sudan is a Muslim country, but now they have a Christian lady on the Sovereign Council. What does that mean?
This is a new phase of the Sudan history. The nomination of this lady, Sudan is respecting the diversity. Muslims, Christians, non-religions, the all Sudanese component have a right to participate.
So the new council, when will it be sworn in? We understand what? Today, Wednesday?
Yes, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, the chairman of the Sovereignty Council is going to take oath in front of the new judiciary president. Also, she is a lady. She is called Nemat. Also, this is the first time also in Sudan a lady to take the office of the judiciary chairman.
Now, who is going to head the Sovereign Council? Who will be the leader? We understand that General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan will be the leader.
Yes, General Burhan is the chairman of the Sovereignty Council.
The announcement of this Sovereign Council, of this council, was supposed to have been done on Sunday, but there were some delays. Can you tell us why?
The delay was for the FFC. They have a lot of different ideas among them. This is why they didn't succeed easily to nominate their numbers. By now, the conflict is solved and the names are declared.
So can we say, Dr. Aga, that Sudan is on the path now toward democracy?
We can say that, but also there is a lot of difficulties that can face this journey, because till now also the armed groups are not part of this constitutional document. They are part of the FFC, but they are not part of this document, because also there is a conflict between the FFC and SRF.
So, Dr. Aga, now what role is your party playing? Are you playing any role at all in the transitional process?
We as revolutionary forces also, and we have our duty that to make the ship of this revolution to reach its harbor.
Thank you very much. You're always very kind to speak with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Farah Aga is the chair of the Blue Nile Forum and Alliance alliance of 14 political parties and 3 civil society organizations. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. A military tribunal in Cameroon has sentenced 10 leaders of the country's Anglophone separatist movement to life in prison. Critics say the sentences will hurt efforts to end the separatist crisis through dialogue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
A tribunal judge sentenced Julius Ayuk Tabe, president of the self-declared Republic of Ambazonia, and 9 of his collaborators to life in prison. The judge, Colonel Misen Johnny Jacques, handed down the sentences Tuesday during a long-heated court session in Yaoundé that was boycotted by defense lawyers. Jacques found the defendants guilty of secession, terrorism, and hostility against the state of Cameroon and ordered them to pay a $50 million fine. Immediately, observers voiced concern the ruling will hurt efforts to derail efforts to end the crisis in the northwest and southwest regions. Armed groups in the 2 mostly English-speaking regions want to break away from Cameroon's French-speaking majority and form a separate nation. Nelson Tawe, a computer engineer, says the sentences could ruin plans to send children back to school in the regions after 3 years of unrest.
At the time when we are preaching back to school, at the time we are preaching unity, at the time we are preaching reconciliation, I think it's stupid of the system to sentence them to life imprisonment. The government should rethink its strategy.
Prince Ekoso, chairman of the opposition United Socialist Democratic Party, says the sentences will lead to more violence.
It is actually a disgrace to democracy. This decision will intensify tension in the northwest and the southwest. It will intensify killings. It will intensify the destruction of properties.
Defense counsel Edwin Fonga says the judge was biased and behaved as though he received instructions from the military. In a telephone interview with VOA, he called the sentencing scandalous and said lawyers will file an appeal.
They have denied justice to those people. We are going to take necessary steps to make sure we go on appeal. You don't judge people in such circumstances without a lawyer. All the lawyers withdrew from the court. They went ahead and passed the judgment.
However, government lawyer Emmanuel Essim says the prison sentences do not stop any talks to solve the crisis. He says Cameroon is a state of law, and the military tribunal, by doing its job, has in no way shut the doors to any dialogue. He says it is not the duty of the military tribunal to grant mercy to people who defied state authority and carry weapons against their own people. The 10 defendants were arrested in Nigeria and extradited to Cameroon in January 2018. Along with Tabe, they include Cornelius Kwanga, Egbe Arok, Eyambe Ebai, Fidelis Ndiche, Kemen Henry, Mfongala Mfo, Augustine Awasum, Shufai Blaze, and Tassan Wilfred. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A spokesperson for Cameroon's Ambazonia separatists says the group is not surprised by the life sentences given to its imprisoned leaders by the Cameroonian government. The government sentenced 10 separatist leaders, including the group's president, Julius Ayuk Tabe, after finding them guilty of terrorism. Chris Anun, Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonian separatist movement, says the 8 million people of English-speaking Cameroon are patriots, not terrorists. He says the only terrorists are Cameroon soldiers who, he said, are burning down towns and villages.
We didn't expect anything new, knowing the regime that sits on power in French Cameroon. They have no law, they do things with impunity, and we were expecting this. The only problem is that it's a dying regime that is marking time. We have made it known to them that Yaoundé does not have jurisdiction over those 10 leaders. They are Ambazonians and not French Cameroonians.
But the government has considered your movement as terrorist. So don't you think they have a right to give the sentence?
They can call us terrorists or whatever name they choose. We are nationalists. We are patriots. 8 million people cannot be terrorists. The only terrorists in this matter are French Cameroon soldiers who are burning down towns and villages. We are defending our freedoms and defending our territory and also upholding our independence as restored 1st of October 2017.
Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 and a half minutes past the hour. South Sudan President Salva Kiir fired his Foreign Affairs Minister Nia Denk Nia on Monday night without explanation. The announcement was made on state radio. Kiir named Awut Denk Akwir, a woman, as Nia's replacement. As Winnie Shirino reports from Juba, some analysts believe President Kiir could be trying to show that his administration values women.
James Cook, a senior research fellow and political analyst at the Juba-based Center for Strategic Policy Studies, says he suspects Nial was removed from his ministerial position because he was scarcely in the capital in recent weeks and months and failed to consult directly with President Kiir.
He was absenting himself too much from Juba, particularly, and this might have created some suspicion from the president that Nial might be sympathizing with Dick Toriak and maybe with those the president is not in good book with.
Okuk says Nial failed to put the Foreign Affairs Ministry on the right track after the country's image was tarnished by the conflict. He says Nial decided on his own to close strategic missions in France, Norway, Kuwait and Israel and dismissed several diplomats who were working outside the country, forcing many to become asylum seekers in the countries to which they were assigned. Okuk says Awut's appointment also shows Mr. Kiir is trying to show that women make important contributions in his administration.
The fact that Awut is the first lady to occupy that position as a full minister of foreign affairs could be also a move from Kiir to tell women and to tell the world that is sympathetic with the women of South Sudan.
Awut is seen as one of Kiir's strongest supporters who represented him at the IGAD-led peace talks, leading to last year's revitalized peace agreement. Okuk says Awut will gain more respect if she manages to reform the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at the headquarters in Juba and the embassies abroad, as well as assign competent people to serve in embassies, unlike previous foreign affairs ministers who were accused of supporting cronyism. As Foreign Affairs Minister, Achuil will head the National Security Council, which is comprised of the Ministries of Defense, Finance, Justice and Foreign Affairs. Jacqueline Asiwa, National Director for the Center for Inclusive Governance, Peace and Justice, says it's good to see a woman appointed to a key position in government. Nasiwa says with a woman leading such a powerful committee, she expects women's rights to be addressed.
I think having a female minister in foreign affairs sitting in that committee will help to elevate the needs of women and their priorities, especially in regards to their protection and security. And therefore, this is a big task, not only to hold the position, but to ensure that women issues are really, really brought on the table and the protection and safety of women become key priority for the national security agenda.
Nasiwa says a handful of South Sudanese women head foreign embassies, and she expects Achuil to promote more women to become ambassadors to improve diplomatic relations with other countries. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
In 2003, Liberian women from all religious backgrounds play a major role in bringing to an end the country's civil war through nonviolent protests, including even the denial of sex to their husbands. Now they are at it again. Today, Wednesday, Liberian women have called for a sit-in action near President George Weah's office to bring attention to what they say is increasing violence against women in the country, particularly and most recently, political violence. Brenda Moore is a member of the Concerned Liberian Women.
Today, we are having a mass sitting action at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Hundreds of women will be gathering there to raise additional awareness on the increased number of violence against women in the country. Last year alone, we've seen almost a double in the number of reported cases of violence against women in Liberia. And so we have a statement that we've prepared. We need from all walks of life. We need from different organizations. We need from different communities. We need who are just tired about the increased number of violence that's happening, you know, against women in the country and want to raise awareness or bring the president's attention to it. We have some demands that we'll be making at the sitting as well.
Ms. Moore, your concerns are noble. So why not just go and meet with the president? Why have a sit-in?
Because for the last 12 months, we have been talking about it, and we have not seen much action from the president or the government as it relates to addressing some of these issues. We are known around the world, Liberian women, for using different mediums for bringing about peace. Recently, we saw serious escalation in violence when it came to the elections in one of the districts in Liberia, Monrovia. And it just re-emphasized to us why we really, really need to speak up, you know, because we have always been key players when it comes to matters of peace in the country. And so this has just pushed us to bring his attention that we are tired of all the violence that's been happening towards women here.
I'm sure a part of the protest or the sit-in has to do with what transpired last Saturday against the candidate, Talia Yure. President Weah has said that he condemned and he wants an investigation. Is that enough?
Like I said, we have a series of demands that we're making tomorrow to the president. But we don't just want another investigation that goes nowhere. We raised an issue several months ago, for example, when it came to the scandal around Modern Me, where you have several children that were raped and infected with HIV, and the government put in another investigation. And it took several months, almost a year, before they came back with the results of the investigation. And even then, the government has not even acted on those recommendations from the committee that he set up. So we don't just want another investigation, we want action to be taken.
You talk about violence against women general on the issue of rape. Liberia has a woman vice president. Are you saying that not much has been done in these areas?
Recently, after we have been advocating for a while, for several years, to be honest, the domestic violence bill has been passed. So we will commend the government for that. But we see that there is not much funding going towards the prosecution of these cases, for rape-reported cases. For years, we complained that people weren't reporting cases. So people are not having a level of confidence in reporting domestic violence, sexual violence. They're reporting it. But then what happens after people report these cases and nothing comes out of it? So we are trying, one of this is trying to get the government to see how they can strengthen the judicial system, how can they strengthen the local authorities to be able to effectively prosecute some of these rape cases.
Ms. Moore, we look forward to speaking with you again later on Wednesday.
Thank you, sir.
Brenda Moore is a member of the Concerned Liberian Women. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. The United Nations says the small oasis town of Manzouk in southwestern Libya has suffered one of the largest losses of civilian life this month since the civil war broke out in 2011 following the overthrow of former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Escalating violence reportedly has killed at least 90 civilians and injured more than 200 in the small oasis town of Morzouk this month. OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, reports airstrikes by planes and drones, indiscriminate rocket attacks and shelling, as well as ground fighting, have increased the casualty count on all sides of the fighting. Additionally, the UN Migration Agency reports nearly 9,500 people have been displaced within the town municipality. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA people are fleeing from one area to another to get out of the way of aerial and drone attacks.
They are, of course, terrified that if they move, they will be perceived as affiliated to one side of the other and may be targeted. So that's why our call really is for those doing the fighting to allow people to leave if they so wish, so they can reach a place where they can be assisted, and of course to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure.
Morzouk is a casualty of the increasingly bitter and lethal fighting between two main armed political factions in Libya. The self-styled Libyan National Army, led by renegade General Khalifa Haftar, raised the fighting to a higher level when Haftar moved to seize the capital, Tripoli, in April. That is where the Government of National Accord, which is recognized by the United Nations as the legitimate government of Libya, is based. Layerke says Murzuk, a town of fewer than 13,000 people, is facing a humanitarian crisis. He says people desperately need medical supplies, food, water and sanitation, tents, blankets and hygiene kits. However, he says aid agencies have limited access to people displaced in the town. He says active fighting, as well as damaged roads and roadblocks, are making it almost impossible to assist the civilians trapped there. He says it is easier to reach those who have taken refuge in the few centers for displaced people on the outskirts of the town. UN aid agencies are appealing to the warring parties for unimpeded access to all victims of this man-made humanitarian disaster. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An attack on Burkina Faso military this week by extremists registered the highest death toll yet in the country's ongoing battle against insurgents. Early this week, 24 soldiers were killed, 7 wounded, and 5 are still missing in the attack in northern Burkina Faso. Henna Nsabia, director of the research and risk consultancy company Minastream, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the ongoing crisis in Burkina Faso.
The attack occurred early in the morning, around 6:30. And according to reports, there were hundreds of bikers and aboard vehicles who attacked a military position in Kotogo, a military camp. And as you know, the chief of staff has communicated on the event, but, you know, with some vague very vague statement in terms of details, but they also confirmed that there was retaliatory airstrikes or air ground operation, even though there were some additional reports that said there were some airstrikes taking place between Kotogo and Bulkesi on the Malian side of the border, and that militants were killed in this operation.
A very high number for the Burkina authorities to lose in one attack, correct?
Yeah, it's the deadliest attack.
What about this area, Kotogo? Is that an uptick in violence for this area, or what does the geographic location of this incident mean in terms of the jihadists making ground?
You know, militant presence in and around Kotogo is continuous since the early days of Ansar al-Islam, and it's very remote geographically, not far from the Mali border. So it's basically a military outpost.
Is this attack, you know, this has just been ongoing, it seems like every other day. While this is a high number of casualties for the armed forces of Burkina, it seems like every other day almost there is a new attack in the countryside, in the rural areas. And what is the latest as far as, is there any progress being made to push back on the militants?
Currently, we are witnessing, you know, an unprecedented humanitarian crisis, you know, which has evolved as the result of this insurgency and associated military operations. So definitely, Burkina Faso's situation is very precarious and complex and multi-layered. So it's not just the insurgency. We also have these accusations about severe abuses on the part of government forces.
That was Henny Nsebia, director of the research and risk consultancy company Minastream. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Sweden. That is it for this Wednesday, August 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington wishing you a very good day.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends? breakout artists? New releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.